Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
One of the highlights of conservation engineering, in my opinion, is the hands-on work that we have, not only in the community, but on the ground with the farmers and ranchers of our nation and our states.
2025 Natural Resources Conservation Service Engineer of the Year, Shane Ice.
I really enjoy my job. I enjoy what I do when it comes to dam safety and the watershed program and conservation engineering overall. One of the larger states is the flood control program. So we have a lot of flood control sites that we work with through rehabilitation and remedial repair and such. So the state conservation engineer would assist in overseeing the design of those repairs and rehabilitations and ensure that it meets all criteria associated with the program.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
I'm struck by the fact that throughout the 20th century, we not only maintained healthy and fire-resilient forests, we made money doing it.
California Representative Tom McClintock at a subcommittee hearing on federal lands.
Federal timber auctions, federal grazing contracts actually generated an enormous flow of capital. 25% of that funding went to local governments that were impacted by the federal lands to compensate them for land that's off their tax rolls. And the other 75% went into our land management agencies, right back into good land management.
Jim Nyman, president and CEO of Wyoming-based Nyman Enterprises.
When I look at what happened in the 90s and the reduction of the Forest Service cutting the volume considerably back, and we lost a lot of sawmills.
And that led, according to McClintock, to more wildfires.
Yeah, we saw that in the Sierra Nevada. We saw a 75% reduction in timber harvested off the federal lands, and we saw a concomitant increase in acreage destroyed by catastrophic fire in the same period. We saw the number of sawmills operating in California go from about, I think it was 180, down to about 30. And we have now entered an era of catastrophic fire. There's nothing new in that. Before the 20th century, paleontologists tell us we lost about 4.5 million acres a year to catastrophic fire in California. But land management brought that down to about 250,000 acres a year, a fraction of what we had lost to nature.
So what needs to happen? Tim Canterbury is a Colorado rancher, president of the Public Lands Council.
We need to very specifically target some funding. Every agency, as you know, is out of funds. We need some funding directly for the monitoring protocols.
That's right.
That we all live by.
Yep.
So the agencies can get this monitoring done.
On the other side of the aisle, Joe Neguse, a representative from Colorado.
My colleague from California, took great umbrage with the idea that the Democratic witness and Democratic members of Congress are demanding more funding. And yet, right here, one of your principal recommendations, and it's a common sense recommendation, by the way, is for more funding for this particular, the nature of the work that you've described. And it's not all that complicated, right? I mean, many of you have testified about multiple use and, some of my colleagues on the other side of the aisle, agree with your assessments regarding timber sales or energy leases. Who manages those? Who do you go to?
So you go to
the federal agencies, right? You go to the BLM.
I deal with my local agency folks. Yes,
correct.
Sir, I do.
Exactly, right? They're federal employees. These are individuals who work for the federal government, particularly the BLM. The same can be said for any number of the multiple uses that this committee is apparently endeavoring to discuss today. My broader point is that as we're discussing multiple use and the benefits of multiple use and the need for the federal government to be more responsive, a mile away, President Trump is endeavoring to gut every federal agency piece by piece. Mass rescission offers, so-called buyout offers to the federal government, including some of the same BLM employees that you work with, sir, that every witness here works with. And it feels a little bit like we're in the twilight zone here. We're supposed to have sort of normal federal land subcommittee hearing to discuss the propriety or the benefits of multiple use and ignore the storm that is developing around us. I mean, I'm sure you all are aware of this. Agencies are being shut down here in Washington. CFPB effectively just a few days ago. I don't know if the BLM will be next. I suppose we're going to find out.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There are some really deep losses, and what we're currently faced with is also the farm safety net is just not adequate.
Current cotton prices 20 to 25 cents below break-even. Dr. Jody Campici with the National Cotton Council.
So most growers were really hoping for passage of a 2024 farm bill last year. That didn't happen. We were able to get some economic assistance and then potentially some disaster assistance later this year. So there will be some relief coming to growers later this year, but again, really is it coming early enough? And it still isn't enough to really cover all the losses.
25 years ago, the industry relied on a domestic textile industry.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, over the years, our production in the U.S. As far as textiles has really declined. So we export about 80% of the raw cotton crop that we produce each year. And then even our textile industry produces yarn and other products that are then shipped out to other countries as well. So then we turn around and we import them all back in. So whenever you hear discussions about potential changes in trade policy, and of course we've heard a lot of that lately, you know, we're really watching those closely because that can definitely impact the U.S. cotton producers and then also the U.S. textile industry.
And with fewer acres expected to be planted in 2025, puts pressure on infrastructure.
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, we've had years where we tended to lose a bit more infrastructure. You know, probably the last 5 to 7 years, we did see a little bit more acreage coming back to areas such as the Mid-South where it kind of declined before. But yes, once the infrastructure goes, it's really hard to actually get cotton production back. And, you know, as well as I do, it's cotton production is an expensive business. And, you know, once you go out and you purchase your picker, maybe you need a new one, it's really hard to then decide that you're not going to plant cotton. And sometimes you just have to make that decision if some of the lower, basically, if, you know, looking at soybeans or corn, you might be able to have lower production costs for some of the other commodities. And that's what some of our growers have had to do. And, you know, in Georgia, we'll likely, I would think we'd likely see more peanuts this year if that much actually comes out of cotton. Now, we still have some time to go. And you know, sometimes on these surveys, producers change their minds before they actually plant. So we could see acreage coming in higher than what the survey shows.
And what about global competition?
So from a global perspective, what we're facing is that the U.S. has experienced strong competition from Brazil. So the U.S. used to be the largest cotton exporter. Several years ago, Brazil surpassed us, and they're actually expected to continue to do that. So, you know, what's kind of happening in Brazil is first they decided to expand soybean acreage, and then they decided to start planting cotton as a second crop behind soybeans. So in just a matter of a couple of years, they've expanded their cotton production by 10 million bales. So it's a lot different situation now than it was, you know, a few years ago. And when we talk about wheat demand and we talk about, you know, plenty of cotton available on the world market, the situation for the U.S. is even more difficult because there's several reasons, you know, Brazil can produce more. Part of it is their climate, their yields are much higher than the U.S. Their production costs are lower, partly due to the depreciation of their real. And then from the U.S. standpoint, the dollar is very strong, and that really impacts our exports because it costs more for other countries to import U.S. cotton. So when you have plenty of Brazilian cotton available and U.S. cotton, but the Brazilian cotton is cheaper, well, in an environment, today's environment, where demand just isn't that strong, everyone is looking for lower cost alternatives.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
The first thing is that the president has told us to prioritize fighting inflation.
Kevin Hassett is the director of the White House National Economic Council. He says there are three key points.
And he had to do that because, as you know, President Biden let inflation get completely out of control. And he did it with policies that made no sense. They made no sense. You know, a lot of times people say to us, our friends, the journalists, you know, why are you doing that? But, you know, I like to think, why did they do that? Why did they spend so much money? And then why did the Fed print so much money so that we had inflation as high as we've ever seen since Jimmy Carter? So why did they do that? So we're addressing inflation. We didn't have to address it in the first term because it was always in the ones, almost always. But we're going to get it back there. And how are we doing it? Well, we're doing it with a plan that President Trump and I and others have talked about in the Oval that involves like every level of fighting inflation. First, the macroeconomic level. We're cutting spending. We're cutting spending in negotiations with people on the Hill. We're cutting spending with the advice of our IT consultant, Elon Musk. And then we're also looking into supply side things, like restoring Trump's tax cuts, maybe even expensing new factories so that there is an explosion of supply. If you have an explosion of supply and a reduction in government demand, then inflation goes way down. And then one of the things that you will want to say is, well, when are you going to see it? Well, the first thing that you'll see when the markets believe that we're going to get inflation under control is that the 10-year Treasury rate goes down, because that's how they think about future expected inflation. And so we're still going to see some memory of Biden's inflation. It's not going to go away in a month. But the 10-year Treasury before the last Consumer Price Index had dropped about 40 basis points. 40 basis points because markets were optimistic about our ability to fight inflation. 40 basis points is kind of not a fun thing to say. I mean, economists talk that way. I apologize. But the way to think about it is, for a typical mortgage, if that affects the mortgage rate, then it's going to save a typical family buying a house about $1,000 a year. And that's just in our first month.
He was in a White House press briefing and said number two deals with trade.
The second thing we've done is we've had a lot of trade talks. In fact, I was just meeting a minister from Mexico with Howard Lutnick just a couple of hours ago. And we're talking about reciprocal trade, and we're also talking about the fentanyl crisis. And so reciprocal trade is about our government treating other governments the way they treat us. We want trade to be fair. It turns out that Americans have been disadvantaged by foreign governments over and over, and President Trump wants it to stop. And the fact that struck me as most noticeable when I started to look at what President Trump was asking us to do is that last year we have data, U.S. companies paid $370 billion in taxes to foreign governments. $370 billion. Last year, foreign multinationals paid us $57 billion in taxes. We have one quarter of world GDP. They have three quarters of world GDP, and we're paying 370, they're paying 57. This is not reciprocal. We're going to try, or we're going to, fix it.
According to Hassett, the third point involves energy.
The other thing that we've done is we've had an all-of-the-above energy approach that's led by Doug Burgum and Chris and a really large team, EPA. And we've already made so many actions that are going to affect the price of energy and lower inflation. We've opened up 625 million acres to energy exploration. We've cut 50 years of red tape that makes it so you can't have permits. And we've even made it so that when you go home, if you get a new one, then you can take a shower or flush a toilet or read under a light bulb. We're doing that too.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
The main thing out there would be to make sure that agriculture is protected.
Ryan LeGrand is CEO of the U.S. Grains Council.
And as we go out and look to put tariffs on, you know, there's reciprocal tariffs that, look, I understand the need for it. Fully understand the need for it. But somewhere in those conversations, you know, with us being an ag exporting powerhouse, we have to find a way to protect agriculture exports, because that's what we're very, very good at. We ship our products to the entire world. And so throughout these negotiations, and look, President Trump, he's on the side of the American farmer. We know he's going to do right by us. But, you know, just that constant reminder, let's protect ag as we go out there and try to right the wrongs of trade that we've seen for many, many years.
An issue that affected U.S. trade recently was low levels in the Panama Canal. Have those improved?
They have certainly leveled out. They've received ample rains. Those lakes that fill the Panama Canal with fresh water, they have been replenished. But, you know, it's going to be a year-to-year thing. I mean, this could happen again. So it's something we've always got to have our eye out on. And, you know, just hope for the best, because we can't control the weather, can't control the climate.
So what's the focus moving forward for the Grains Council?
You know, we're focused on value-added exports today. It's getting tougher and tougher to compete in a commodity world of exporting corn and barley and sorghum commodities. We're still doing our part there, and we still have decent numbers, but there's some big competition coming on that they've been coming for the last several years, Brazil, Argentina, even Ukraine, pre-war. So what we want to focus on now is that value-added trade. producing ethanol, producing DDG and the high-pro DDG that's coming out of our ethanol plants today, moving on to SAF and looking for other applications for ethanol like clean cooking, like bio-based chemicals. These are the type of things that we want to work on to add the value and the jobs in the United States and export that value to the world.
But the U.S. Grains Council has a public-private partnership with the government through MAP and FMD.
So at the U.S. Grains Council, we cannot lobby Congress, but we've got a lot of organizations and farmers that are able to do that, and they've been very effective in explaining to Congress that MAP and FMD has not been increased since 2006, and through inflation and sequestration, we've lost about half of that value from that baseline that was set in 2006. These funds have been proven to show about a 23-to-1 return on investment for MAP and FMD. So it's about the best money that can be spent in terms of promoting exports and affecting policy around the world to get more ag exports out. We'd certainly like to see it. We've seen write-ups where MAP and FMD could be doubled. We hope that's seen through to the end in the next farm bill. And I can tell you that U.S. Ag would be a large benefactor of an increase in MAP and FMD.
While MAP and FMD funding come from the government, it's based upon cost share with farmers.
When you look at priorities, when you get behind after the insurance, safety net, for the farmers being their number one priority, trade is typically number two, and within that subset is trade in ethanol, trade in DDG, trade in value-added products. It always really tops the list or gets very near the top of the list for farmers, and they're active. They've been very good in telling their story and telling the need for exports, and it's great support.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Let's be honest, it's going to be challenging, especially with the farm bill. Right now, we had a lot of things in that the last farm bill that were used for pay-fors that will probably be used for in the reconciliation bill now.
Iowa Representative Randy Feenstra is a member of the House Ag Committee and the Ways and Means Committee and admits Congress has a lot of work to do.
I have great confidence in our chairman, Geechee Thompson. He talks to us virtually every day. He's a brilliant man on how to strategize and get this done. And I really think by this summer, we're going to have a farm bill on the table ready to go and get it passed. I think we owe that to our producers. We owe that to our country of getting this five-year extension done on the farm bill also.
What is the future of TCJA, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act?
The wonderful thing, I'm the only one in Congress that sits on both. So I sit on Ag and I sit on Ways and Means, and working with Chairman Smith in Ways and Means, he also understands that we have to make sure we extend those tax cuts. And for the farmers, we talk about 199A, if you're a pass-through, that's so important, or death tax, estate tax, that has to be extended. I mean, right now, if you have $7 million, everything above that will have to be paid at 40% tax. So there's over 200 supporters of the death tax to get that extended to maybe even get it to $20 million worth of exemption. So working with Senator Thune, we just came out with bill together last week on that, and we're hoping to get that done in the reconciliation bill.
When it comes to trade, oversight belongs to the Ways and Means Committee. Hasn't been much in 4 years.
It is. It's frustrating being on Ways and Means and trade. In the last 4 years, we have opened zero new trade markets. Zero. And you think about that. So when you talk about export markets, whether it be corn, soybeans, wheat, cotton, we haven't opened anything. Cattle, hogs, dairy. And now we have that opportunity. And, we're really working with the administration right now. You know, everybody's hearing about tariffs, but I'm also hearing about the opportunity to have new export markets for all our commodities. And that's exciting to hear about, to get into Africa, to get into India, to get into other countries. And that's, to me, my focus, especially on Ways and Means that handles trade, whether it be AGOA, whether it be some other trade opportunities. It's going to be an exciting time in the next 4 years of how we can open some of these markets, because a lot of these countries are desperate for our commodities.
Speaking of frustration, Harriet Hageman is a representative from Wyoming at a recent hearing on public lands.
You know, one of the things that bothers me so much about Washington, D.C., and Representative Malloy has touched on it a couple of times here, we're $36 trillion in debt in this country. And what that means is we've spent massive amounts of money with deficit spending. Deficit spending in and of itself is bad, but it also covers up a lot of really bad policies. It's wonderful to have flowery language about protecting recreation and the Belknap and the little, you know, the flower here, and I want to see a tortoise there. It's so fine and dandy to say all of that. Which when you destroy your communities and destroy your tax base, you become incapable of actually protecting the very environment you profess to love. There has to be a balance in the way that we manage these resources. These catastrophic forest fires are spewing more carbon into the atmosphere than every single car in the entire country in a matter of months. What we saw in California is an absolute tragedy beyond anyone in this room's imagination. And it is because of failed land use policy and a refusal of people to recognize that global warming and climate change and screaming that at the top of your lungs isn't going to do a damn thing to fix any of this. It is imperative that we manage these resources for the best interests of the American citizens. I appreciate you being here and being willing to talk about common sense solutions and why we must change course if we are going to protect and preserve these resources into the long distant future.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Guess what? Small business optimism has gone up by the most ever since President Trump came in.
Kevin Hassett is director of the National Economic Council on Growing Optimism and Confidence.
ISM, which is the measure of what's going on in manufacturing, it's expanding again for the first time in years. CEO confidence is the highest it's been in years. And the reason people are thinking this is that our policies give people cause for optimism. And then I want to reiterate what Stephen Miller said, because it's so important, and it's so important for financial markets to start to digest this, that if, say, the Treasury Secretary or any Cabinet Secretary with Elon Musk is able to find some savings, say $100 billion, well, in CBO land, that's actually like about 10 times that, or maybe 12 times that, over a 10-year window. And so when you're thinking about the negotiations right now over reconciliation and thinking about, well, $4 trillion, $5 trillion, well, those numbers in terms of the savings are going to end up being small because of all the waste that we're finding. And so we're incredibly optimistic about the future of inflation and the future of our economy, and we're optimistic because we're making so much progress so far, and we already see it in market prices.
During a White House press briefing, was asked about recent IRS job cuts.
Well, I think our objective is to make sure that the employees that we pay are being productive and effective. And there are many, many, more than 100,000 people working to collect taxes, and not all of them are fully occupied. And the Treasury Secretary is studying the matter and feels like 3,500 is a small number and probably can get bigger, especially as we improve the IT at the IRS. And so I think that it's absolutely something that is on the table for good reasons. And the point is that don't just talk about the IRS. Talk about all of government. That there are so many places. I live in D.C. You maybe live in D.C. where nobody's going to the buildings. People aren't commuting because nobody's doing their job. We look back and we see that there are all these people doing two jobs while they're getting a government payroll on the payroll. So the point is we're fixing that. And the IRS is a small part of that picture.
Stephen Miller is the White House Deputy Chief of Staff, talks about Elon Musk involvement.
It is also true that many people in this room who have used this talking point that Elon is not elected fail to understand how government works. So I'm glad for the opportunity for a brief civics lesson. A president is elected by the whole American people. He's the only official in the entire government that is elected by the entire nation, right? Judges are appointed, members of Congress are elected at the district or state level, which is one man. And the Constitution, Article 2, has a clause known as the vesting clause, and it says the executive power shall be vested in a president, singular. The whole will of democracy is imbued into the elected president. That president then appoints staff to then impose that democratic will onto the government. The threat to democracy, indeed the existential threat to democracy, is the unelected bureaucracy of lifetime tenured civil servants who believe they answer to no one, who believe they can do whatever they want without consequence, who believe they can set their own agenda no matter what Americans vote for. So Americans vote for radical FBI reform, and FBI agents say they don't want to change. Or Americans vote for radical reform on our energy policies, but EPA bureaucrats say they don't want to change. Or Americans vote to end DEI, racist DEI policies, and lawyers of the Department of Justice say they don't want to change. What President Trump is doing is he is removing federal bureaucrats who are defying democracy by failing to implement his lawful orders, which are the will of the whole American people.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Among the various online resources available to ag producers and tax professionals to assist in return preparation, www.ruraltax.org. Clemson University Extension's Kevin Burkett is among the land-grant university tax experts making up the National Farm Income Tax Extension Committee, which administers the ruraltax.org website.
Our publications that we try to provide education through, that's housed through Utah State University, where you can find more information about the committee and a lot of the articles and things that have been published.
Among the cooperative extension tax experts participating in this committee, the University of Minnesota's Rob Holcomb, from a video discussing crop insurance payments and tax implications.
We do want to look at those reporting requirements. We also want to differentiate between revenue protection and protection for damage and destruction, because those get treated differently for deferral purposes.
I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.